the way that MFJ is marketing it as a adjustable counterpoise. There might be two models that sort of are promoted for different purposes that are electronically equivalent.
VDH with a comment?
Yes, John.
I think the artificial ground is primarily just to tune out the impedance of a long wire going to earth ground, where, as you say, you're in an apartment building maybe two or three flights up, and to get to earth ground might be a long wire. So this essentially tunes out the inductive reactance or any other kind of reactor you have this so that you have a good RF going to ground. It has nothing to do with lightning. For lightning, you need the shortest, directest route to earth ground as you can with the thickest wire. So this has nothing to do with lightning protection. That's a whole other ballgame. But I think this is just to tune out any reactors in your ground wire. Go ahead.
Okay, I was pointing out that the reason why I and many other people use copper strapping instead of copper wire is that copper strapping has less inductive impedance in the ground wire. And so any additional impedance, lightning might find a lower conducting, shorter pathway. Let me just, for the sake of arguments, read what I got from MFJ Enterprises' site. It mentions the MFJ-931 artificial ground, and it says it creates an artificial RF ground. It resonates a random wire, length of wire thrown along the floor, and produces a tuned counterpoise. That's what they have on their site.
So that means it's making a length of wire, which look like, so let's say, for example, a quarter way where the far end is open circuited. So a quarter way from an open circuit would look like a short. Okay, so in that case, then, it would make it look like a low impedance point. So you could put length of wires out and then, with this artificial ground, make them look like a very low impedance point at the base of your antenna. Okay. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I could see the confusion, but that apparently is the understanding that I had for this device. I think all things being equal, probably best to have a legitimate counterpoise. Then there's the question of if you have a multi-band antenna, how do you optimize the counterpoise for all the different bands? I have seen manufacturers offer different lengths of radials to be optimized for different bands. So that opens up another can of worms.
W2BZ?
Yes, Rich?
Does a vertical have radials and a counterpoise?
The radials act as a counterpoise. The counterpoise act as a radial. We're just calling them different things because they look slightly different. If you have one wire hooked up to ground that just kind of floats there, we call it a counterpoise. If we have a number of wires set out in a radial configuration, we tend to call them radials. But effectively, electronically, they serve very, very similar purposes. The benefit of radial distribution as opposed to a single counterpoise is that it will produce a more uniform omnidirectional pattern. If you mount an antenna, say, on the back of your car, and you use the body of your car as the counterpoise, the nature of your radiation pattern is going to favor the forward direction against the side and the back, simply because of that distribution of the metal acting as a counterpoise. Radials are symmetrical and give you a more omnidirectional radiation pattern.
because MFJ markets this for people in apartments, you know, or just for people who can't run a proper ground wire from their rig to earth ground. They market it for people where that's an impossibility, and this is a substitute for that. Running again from the MFJ with the shortest wire as possible to the ground of your rig, and then the other terminal attach the length of wire that you're going to use, and that's how you set up the artificial ground. So it seems like they are talking about a substitute for an earth ground.
And yet their material talks of a counterpoise, which is a different thing. So perhaps the person in charge of their website is confused about the purpose for this. Again, as far as I can discern, these are two very similar concepts that operate in somewhat similar fashions. By changing the capacitance and the inductance of a piece of wire, you're tuning it as a counterpoise, and also you can use it as a kind of a ground impedance corrector, so that you dial up the capacitance, and so the inductive impedance of a long piece of wire is neutralized for the sake of a proper RF ground. So again, I tend to think, unfortunately, that the same device has two purposes, and both of them are mentioned in their literature. Yes, Wesley?
Okay. So, I found an interesting comment. And it says, if we have a wire, any wire of any length, and we want to, let's say a random wire, but we want to work on HF and possibly on 6 meters. So the counterpoise is not called counterpoise any longer. It is just leg of a dipole. Because nature likes the balance. How do you like that?
Well, about a half hour ago, I kind of made the same point. If you're going to have a balanced antenna, you don't need a counterpoise. Counterpoises are only required for unbalanced antennas. So if you use a dipole, you have two elements. It's balanced. It can operate in free space. It does not need anything more. In the case, though, of, say, ham sticks that we mentioned earlier or a whip, it is not a balanced antenna. It is an unbalanced antenna. And as I mentioned about the seesaw, you have to provide some form of electrical balance. And the way to provide that in the case of unipole unbalanced antennas is either a radial or in another name, a counterpoise. They both perform the same balancing act for an unbalanced non-center-fed dipole antenna.
Also, the point from that comment, the long comment is that it is not that you have universal counterpoise. For 6 meters, your counterpoise will be different than for HF. And in HF, depends from the frequency that you're operating at, your counterpoise will be different. Interesting.
Yes, and I mentioned that a little while ago as well. There are designers, guys who are selling multi-band devices that are unbalanced in design that feature lengths of radials, different lengths of radials for optimized for different bands. So, yeah, that's true. If you want to have a counterpoise for a 10-meter quarter-wave antenna, the counterpoise is going to probably the efficient. Most efficient counterpoise is not going to be the same length as a counterpoise for a 20-meter vertical quarter-wave antenna.
I just didn't hear what you said because I just switched on the radio. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Wesley. Anyone else with who wants to point out anything about this subject tonight? Okay. Well, we're coming to a close, but let me just give a yell out to John, KC2SHO, if he's still around there out there. I see he's connected to the IRLP, but, you know, he might be dealing with something else. If you're out there, John, please come back. Okay. Again, this is AC2GS. We're kind of... don't have that much time left on this portion of the technical net, but if anyone has any comments, questions, topics for discussion, or what have you, please hit that push-to-talk button.
Actually, I have one. The little coil of capacitor that is on the side of the car that is connecting your vertical antenna is actually your artificial ground. Do you agree with that?
I'm not quite sure what you mean by the little coil. Usually in car antennas, they use the chassis and the surface of the car as the counterpoise. In the case of magnetic mount antennas, there is it's not a direct electrical connection. It's a capacitive coupling. The magnet attaches to the ferrous metal of the chassis, and there's a small gap, which is already pre-calculated, that provides a capacitive coupling with the chassis and the car that supplies the proper counterpoise. So I wouldn't exactly call it an artificial counterpoise, and it's not adjustable. So it just happens to be a counterpoise.
The most visible for the antennas, long antennas mounted on the bumper or the rear of the car, especially if you have motorized antennas for multi-band operation, you have a small coil and you have a capacitor, you actually have a resonant filter. It is compensating the difference between the chassis or the body of the car and the antenna to make it somehow balanced.
I am not exactly sure what you're alluding to. There are many antennas, mobile antennas, that use coils. The coils, as far as I'm aware, are not meant to act as an impedance transformer for the counterpoise. They are usually meant to offset the fact that they're using a shortened whip for a given frequency, which produces increased capacitive reactance and a non-resonant shortened antenna. In order to bring it back into resonance, you have to deal with the residual capacitive reactance of a non-resonant mechanical antenna. You do that with a loading coil. You could put the loading coil any place, but mechanically the safest place to put a loading coil is at the base. So the loading coil is not connected to the ground. It's connected to the radiating antenna. And as I mentioned, I'm not quite sure if all mobile antennas have a capacitor. Those that are mounted with a magnetic field have an effective capacitor that's coupling with the counterpoise. But with non-magnetic mounted antennas, mobile antennas, you supply an actual electrical contact to the chassis, to the bumper, to whatever you have that's grounded to the body of the metal of the car.
I'm sure many time radio operators, they recall that they saw when the antenna is mounted to the connector, the connector is mounted to the chassis or to the bumper, then at that point at the bottom you have a few turns of the coil, and the capacitor usually is trying to find. I saw it somewhere, about 1.5 microfarad. And that is, that depends from what car do you have, and then usually it is enough for you to stretch that coil a little bit or tighten it, to tune it, and to action.
Okay. I am totally unfamiliar with the generalization that you just mentioned. Again, I am well aware that there is an inherent capacitance in magnetic mounted. I'm not really familiar with the idea that there are tuned circuits on the grounding portion of most mobile antennas. I am willing to hear from people out there. All you guys have a lot more experience, number of people, number of years, what have you. Are any of you out there aware of mobile antennas that require, that include the tuning circuits on the grounded side of a quarter wave vertical for mobile use? Unfortunately, you're doubling with someone, Wesley. I'm not quite sure. It might be John. I'm not sure. So we'll get to you in a minute, Wesley. The other person, can you ID again? Yes.
The only antennas I can think of that might have that connection to ground, like you're talking about, would be the stealth antennas, where they're shoving a bunch of capacitive and inductive components into a much smaller little puck or stub or whatever you want to call it. But that, I don't think that meets your requirement of being on a quarter wave or half wave type antenna. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think that Wesley is talking about a mobile whip antenna, and all the mobile whip antennas that I am aware of don't feature that, except as I mentioned earlier, magnetic mount. So that's what I'm trying to get a sense of. I'm sure that there has to be at least 100 different mobile mounted antennas that people listening tonight have dealt with. Do any of them have tuned circuits on the counterpoise portion of the antenna? I'm just asking if people have any experience with a design that sounds like that I'm unaware of.
KD2WOT.
Yes, Chris.
The antenna that gentleman was referring to, it's a one Yaesu, what is it, ATS 120A, I think. It operates, I believe, like a screwdriver antenna. I believe it's motorized.
That is correct.
KD2, KFR.
Yes, Stephen?
Yeah, the gentleman right before that is correct. The antenna that I have, the Yaesu ATS 120, is motorized. So whenever you pick the band, it raises up to the appropriate length that's supposed to be best for that band.
Okay, so Chris, you got your answer. It's a screwdriver antenna. It still requires some form of a counterpoise to operate optimally. because it's designed to be a mobile antenna. It doesn't have a variable method of dealing with the counterpoise. It just takes the car chassis at face value and deals as best it can with the diminishing efficiencies as you use it for lower and lower frequencies. You might be able to match the impedances with the adjustment of the loading coil, but because of other factors involved, you will increase the effect of insertion loss and such, and it will become an increasingly less efficient antenna design. Also, the static nature of the counterpoise will have an effect on the efficiency as well.
KD2WOT. Yeah, and I believe that there's also an attachment that you can get with that antenna, which will serve as the radials.
KD2KFR.
Yes, Stephen.
Yeah, it does come with a radio kit, but the radios, it doesn't come with it. You can buy a radio kit separately, but according to the manual, that is just for UHF and VHF. They're really short radios and probably wouldn't work for HF.
Okay, but thank you for that. Yeah, I wasn't clear on that. That makes a lot of sense.
Well, so far I'm not hearing anyone who knows about tuned circuits on counterpoise portions of mobile whips. So I'm assuming that no one listening tonight has that experience. So I don't know what to tell you, Wesley. A center-fed dipole has a nominal impedance in free space of about 73 ohms. A quarter-wave antenna, which is half of a center-fed half-wave dipole, has an impedance of 36 ohms. So it makes sense. It's 36 ohms on either side. It totals 73 or so. And as you slide the feed point around, it does curious, interesting things. But it's not only just it's not that things have to be perfectly balanced to work. It's just that they work far better if they're balanced than they're increasingly imbalanced. And so you need some kind of a counterpoise if you're going to use a unipolar radiating element to act as the other side of the seesaw. The closer it is to an equivalent circuit, the more efficient it probably is, but in this imperfect world, people kind of cut corners and they operate kind of almost like offset center-fed Wyndham type of antennas where the counterpoises are not perfectly balancing, but enough to have an effective, relatively efficient radiating antenna to get the job done.
Yeah, when we reach to the point that counterpoise is
just an arm or a dipole. Could be seen as that. And we had discussion a few weeks ago, or maybe last week, when you and me, we agreed that we don't know how perfect the balance should be. That how much of the counterpoise or the ground or the earth is cooperating with the given length of the antenna. You can reword it for better understanding.
Implementing antennas always tends to be a compromise in action. Sometimes we're knowledgeable of what compromise we're making. Sometimes we have a good inkling, and sometimes we don't have a clue. If you really, really want to operate mobile out of your car at 180 meters, are you willing to use a device that's been measured to be efficiency of less than 1%? If that less than 1% does get you contacts, as opposed to not using it at all, where you're guaranteed not to make any contacts. And so ultimately, some are more knowledgeable compromises than others, but in the end, they're all compromises.
In other words, if I recall that antenna that we spoke about was how the ground knows how much of that ground is supposed to resonate with the dipole. So we have a vertical dipole, we have a counterpoise. If we see it as a vertical dipole, let's see two arms, two legs, right? We know that we have a 10 meters or 10 feet long one that is up in the air. So then the other one, if we put it all in the air, should be also 10 feet. Now we have a balance. Now, let's say we don't have that arm. We have the kind of voice, or we have the ground. How does the ground know which part of that ground is supposed to cooperate or resonate? How is that done? You said I don't know. I said I don't know.
Okay, so unless you've had an epiphany in the last few weeks, then we're in the same place we were before. What happens is things approximate, equilibrate, and you kind of, you suffer with whatever you have. Is the earth ground being a perfect counterpoise? I would submit no. It's a very lossy counterpoise. So again, none of this is perfect. How it kind of comes to whatever equilibration point it does, I don't know, and neither do you, and neither does anyone who's listening out there. So I don't know what to tell you about this one, except that you do need a counterpoise. And counterpoise are not cut and dry. You cannot simply show an equation or some PhD thesis and tell you that these are the proper number, configuration, and size. It is such a soft, squishy subject that there are a lot of competing, unproven opinions of what an optimal counterpoise should be. I mean, ultimately, you sort of mentioned that in a perfect universe, the counterpoise would just be the other leg of a half-wave center dipole, except that people aren't using center-fed dipoles, and so they're dimensionally in non-equivalent. They're not going at 180 degrees from each other, and they're not always the same size, and all kinds of different things. So that's where reality, you know, kind of makes its mark.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Wesley. Well, this has been fun. I hope everyone enjoyed themselves. I hope a few people learned some things. I hope a few people taught other people things. And I hope you all enjoyed the experience, and hope you'll come back next Sunday when we try and do this all over again. Now is 10:30, and certainly time for Paul WS2N with the SpaceNet report. Take it away, Paul.
Okay, thanks, Roy. AC2GS WS2N. Very good in that tonight. And talking about DX, like you were earlier tonight, there is one station from United Arab Emirates. They have a special event station, and it's dealing with their astronaut program. They're creating their own astronauts. They actually have one guy that was on the Crew Dragon that went up to the International Space Station last week. He's up there now for the next 6 months. So anyway, up until August 31st, they have a special event station. And you'd have to look for the call letter A, alpha, you know, as an alpha 60 AP. And anyway, if you see an AP station on 20 meters or something, I would go after that. They didn't say what bands they're going to be working on. They didn't even say what modes they're going to be on, but they're going to be on. So that's one that I would be looking for. Let me drop it. And they're actually using two call letters. But my guess, if it's an AP-60 station and you hear it, it's probably them. You know, if it's a pile-up or something. The news recently the other day, they came out with they're going to have a reveal on the spacesuits that Artemis is going to be using for actually walking around on the moon. They're not going to use the old spacesuits that are laying around from the Apollo days. They're going to have brand new ones. And this company, Axiom, has got the contract from NASA to develop these spacesuits. And they're going to put it on their NASA TV. It'll carry it 10:30 in the morning on Wednesday. So I'm going to look forward to that and see what they've designed, you know, for their backpack and for the shoes and the type of helmet they have. Should be interesting. And I'm sure it'll be all over the NASA websites and, you know, Space News, any of the those websites will be carrying it. But that's definitely NASA and also the Axiom website as well. Let me drop it. I'm also interested in what kind of communication system they're going to be using. You know, talking back to the Artemis lander system, which will be supposed to be a SpaceX Starship that they're going to be using. What kind of communication system they'll have between astronauts. You know, they'll always have at least two astronauts walking around the surface at the same time. What kind of links they'll be using. Let me just drop it 1 second here. WS. Okay, the Crew Dragon. Crew was the number 5 that just came back. They brought 4 astronauts back yesterday. They landed in the Gulf of Mexico. They'd like to land in the Atlantic Ocean, but the conditions weren't right there, so they always have an option. They could either go to the Gulf of Mexico or the Atlantic. They landed very close to Tampa, Florida, and they were picked up by SpaceX ship that's specially designed for that. You know, they actually pull it out of the water. Once it's on the ship, they open the door and the crew comes out. So they're safely back. That brings the total crew crew on the International Space Station back to 7. Just for a short period of time, they had 11. But that's a standard operating procedure. Anytime they bring a crew back, they always send a crew up first, and then that crew returns after they arrive. So you had Anna Kikina from Roscosmos. She came back. You had Josh Cassada. He was the commander with Nicole Mann. She was a pilot as well as a fellow from Japan. So they safely returned. They landed in the water, of course. They splashed down, and they picked up by the boat, and then they're flown back to Houston. From there, they go to their respective locations. You know, Anna will be sent back to Russia, to Star City, which is part of Roscosmos. And the fellow will go back to Japan. And the other two, of course, will stay in the United States. Maybe they'll be on a future Artemis mission, if that thing ever gets going the way I hope it does. This is WS2N. Any comments? Now, talking about the different things that are going to be on TV next week. That you plan on giving out all the information from the Artemis 2 mission that will be coming up. One thing that they released is they plan on sending that mission in November of 2024. November of next year will be the next Artemis mission. And very shortly they will be announcing the crew. It's going to be three people from the United States. One person from Canada. That's all we know so far. But they will be announced. Their job will be to get in the Artemis, the Orion vehicle, and they will launch toward the moon, very similar to what they did with Artemis 1 that was unmanned. And this time you're going to have a crew of four, and they're not going to land on the moon. They're going to orbit the moon and then return. So it will be a 10-day flight. Of course, that's a big difference between Artemis 1, which was, you know, almost a month. The capability of just going there and back is going to be an extremely big mission. If that, of course, is successful, the following year they plan on actually sending a crew to land on the moon. But a lot of things have to happen before that takes place. One thing is the spacesuit. Glad to see that they're finally getting somewhere with the spacesuit situation. That was being held up. The contract has been let out, and now we'll see if they're ready in a couple of years for those spacesuits. And then the other thing that could hold them up would be the human landing system, the HLS they call it. You know, going from lunar orbit down to the surface and back. The present plan is still to use the SpaceX Starship, which has never flown yet. And all goes right this month. They plan on launching that humongous vehicle from Boca Chica, Texas. They don't plan on recovering anything. Eventually it would be a reusable system. For the first flight, they're going to be happy to almost orbit the Earth. The booster will separate, go back to the, and land in the Gulf of Mexico. And the Starship will continue on and also land in the water in the Pacific Ocean, north of Hawaii. But if all that happens, SpaceX will be very happy, and then the next couple of flights after that, they plan on eventually landing these vehicles back on Earth. Long way to go. Eventually the Starship to the moon. I mean, it's under development, but I don't. Right now, I don't see how they're going to be able to do this in time in a couple of years to actually put one of these things in orbit around the moon and then land on the moon with the Starship. You know, they have to do a couple of practice flights too. But, you know, before they do that, they're going to actually have to land one of these Starships on the moon without a crew. So, I mean, there is another contract that's being released to develop another human landing system by other company. The development of that is, as far as I know, not that far along. So we'll see. I think that would be the stone that will break the camel's back, you might say, instead of the straw. That's a big problem. Any comments?
WB2KWC.
I can, go ahead. WS2M.
Okay, in the previous segment, you were talking about how they changed the crew, and I'm thinking if they have two crews up there, wouldn't that get kind of crowded? I mean, what do they do about that?
I guess a week and a half, so they've had 11 people on board, and, you know, standard number right now is 7, and so, you know, you've got a crew of 4 up, now you have the 11. There is enough room to handle that. They have sleeping bunks, there's 4 of them in the Harmony node, and Tranquility node. And there's different nodes. There's 3 big nodes on the space station. Tranquility node, they have 4 different places that people sleep. And then the Russians have 3 now. They used to have just 2. Now they have 3 locations for the Russians. So that's okay for the standard 7. When the extra 4 go up, they sleep in different places. One person always bunks in the Columbus module, so they have that all to themselves. That would be my favorite one because that's where the American amateur radio is set up in that module, in the Columbus module. And then the other 3, there's always one that'll actually bunk in one of the Dragon crew vehicles. They'll sleep in there. And then there's 2 more spots, and sometimes they'll stay in the Quest lab. The Quest is like 2 rooms. You go into one room, you can hang out there, and then it's on the small side, but it doesn't matter if you're just sleeping. And then there's the second room. Of course, you don't go into that because that's where you would go for an EVA. They manage. They've had as many as 13 at one time up there for a very short period of time. But they managed it. There has been 2 bathrooms for them for quite a while. And I think with the Russians, they came up with the 3rd one about a year or so ago with the docking of their final module. So, they're okay. And then supplies, they just keep sending up one crew, one cargo vehicle after another for supplies, and they say it's so crowded up there. I mean, they have stuff all over. Just to get from one end to the other, they have to keep everything clear because if there's an emergency, they got to be able to get from one end to the other real fast. But there's stuff all over. Anyway, back to you, Cass.
Just curious because you said they've got a crew up there and they're bringing another one up and just wondering where they put them. Okay, thank you, Paul.
Thomas, I like the Tranquility sleeping arrangements. They have, there's 4 beds, so one guy's on one wall, figure this big round, big gigantic tin can, right? So on one wall, that's one area, and then opposite him is the other. And then on the floor is another person, and then on the ceiling is another. Very small, but that's what they have, and then that's their own little location. They go in there, they have their tablet on the wall, they have a sleeping bag attached to the wall, so they go into that and they zip it up, and, you know, that's their own little room. It's pretty cool. Any other comments? Question I heard, go ahead.
This is KV2 of UAH, Paul. It is Rocco. I have a question, and just maybe a comment. You know, you were talking about circling the moon and landing an unmanned craft on the moon, and then hopefully at some point landing people on the moon. I'm going to let it drop. I just find it really odd, you know, that with our technology today, 54 years ago, we put people on the moon using rudimentary computers and so forth. Why is it that they can't draw on even the old technology and all of these preparatory steps are necessary now when they had technology 54 years ago? And then you look at the progress that's been made in aviation in only a 40, 50-year period. It's just very hard to believe that they don't have the technology to just go for broke, so to speak. Back to the next.
I've thought about that as well, but, you know, the idea, from my reading, is they want to stay there. They eventually want to set up a base on the moon, but before that, they want to set up a space station around the moon, because a base on the moon is going to be very problematic in the beginning. They'd like to stay there for days on end, you know, for a whole lunar day, not night, like 14 days. I mean, that's the ultimate goal for now. And eventually, as time goes on, and once they can, you know, really perfect these habitats and power systems to, you know, to keep these places warm during the lunar night, which would be another 14 days, you know, then you could actually have a permanent base there. In this case, if they want to do it on the South Pole. But they're trying to develop all this technology to not just, you know, land there, plant the flag, and come home. You know, they could have done that. This is a permanent situation. Gateway, for instance, they want to put a space station where it could be manned all the time or part-time around the moon. And then as crews go up, they'll dock with the Gateway space station. Leave the space, you know, leave their Orion spacecraft, go inside the space station, and then go into another vehicle that's attached to that space station. HLS, a human landing system. So the first one will be the Starship by SpaceX, and they have another one that's being designed by Northrop Grumman and Blue Origin's involved, but, you know, they plan on eventually having a completely different system than SpaceX. Well, long story short, you get into this vehicle, go down and land on the moon, stay there for days at a time. Which, in the beginning, of course, it's going to be a relatively short period of time, but eventually, as time goes on, they'd like to stay for the whole lunar day, you know, up to 14 days. That's going to take a lot of flights, a lot of work, and a lot of infrastructure. Right now, there's going to be landing unmanned vehicles, which we did in the beginning. In the 1960s, we landed six Surveyor spacecraft around the moon, you know, just to see if we could do it, test landing procedures, see what the moon was made of, and before that, you had the Ranger missions, which would just even crash into the moon before that, and then you eventually had the lunar orbiter missions.
So there was some infrastructure involved in the 1960s, but here they're going to go overboard. So, you know, they plan on having these vehicles, even maybe, you know, rovers in place as time goes on. When they get there, the rover's going to be there instead of what Apollo did. They brought a rover with them on a spacecraft. So, the idea is to not only just go to the moon, but to actually stay there. And that's quite difficult. The Orion spacecraft was designed to be reusable. They've pretty much quit that idea for now. They plan on reusing parts. Of course, the Apollo vehicle was never designed to be reusable. So there's a lot of different things that they're doing between, you know, for these missions compared to the 1960s. UHS, back to you, WS.
Do you envision something like the escape, not geostationary, a lunar stationary asylum station? In case something goes wrong.
Kind of a station, Wesley, in case something goes wrong?
Like we have International Space Station, right? If something goes wrong, they have emergency vehicles they can actually escape. How that is being envisioned in our neighbor planet, the planet, in moon. If anything goes wrong, do they have anything in space nearby they could escape to?
Well, you're just gonna have the Gateway space station, which they plan on building. I mean, yep. They're building hardware for this Gateway space station now. There's going to be a habitat section. There's going to be a power segment. They're going to be, bolted together. Actually, two of them are going to be bolted together before they launch from Earth on a SpaceX Heavy mission. They'll be the first two segments to go into lunar orbit, and they're going to send it into this halo retrograde orbit, which is going to be a highly elliptical orbit. So it would take 11 days for the space station to go all the way around the moon. So that means that roughly every 11 days you'll be able to leave the moon and dock with the space station. So during those 11 days, if you're on the moon and there's some kind of an emergency, it might be a problem to get off the moon real quick and try to dock with that space station. Roughly 11 days, because it's going to, highly elliptical. It'll come close to the moon. Okay, now you can bail out and dock with that space station. If something goes wrong with the space station, that's another problem. There's not much you can do. You're 4 days away from landing on Earth. I mean, if the space station starts leaking, I guess you can get into your Orion spacecraft and then, separate from the Gateway and make your way back to Earth. That's about it, Wesley. That's why they need to have all this infrastructure in place. I mean, they have landers planning on landing there, very soon. I mean, by the time we actually land a crew there, they actually hope to have a lander near the landing site. So you'll be able to see live HD pictures of, of this spacecraft coming in for a landing with the first crew on board. This is what they're planning. Back to you, Wesley.
How are they going to do that? The infrastructure, how the men being there to be prepared to at least film the arriving spacecraft.
Yeah, the infrastructure, they plan on setting up a lot of infrastructure before they get there. In the beginning, the only habitat itself will be whatever they come down on. It looks like a starship right now. I'm kind of hoping for another vehicle that Blue Origin had in mind. You know, that's still on the drawing board. You know, I like that design. You know, it's very similar to what we have with the Apollo landing. It's really two spacecraft in one. You know, you're going to come down on a descent engine, land on the moon, and then use that descent engine as a platform for launching the top half and going back to lunar orbit that way. You know, I'm in favor of that. Starship, you know, you're bringing this whole starship down. You're going to land it, hope it don't fall over. You need some kind of a pulley type of system they're going to have to bring the astronauts all the way down from the, you know, this 100-foot tall starship down to the ground and back up again. You know, we'll see as time goes on. We'll see. We've got plenty of time to talk about. I did want to talk about two other things before I run out of time here. Let me just continue. WS2N.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Leslie. I waited last week for the Taran 1 rocket to take off. I'm interested in this one. It's built by a company called Relativity Space. They tried to take off on Wednesday for the first flight. Eventually that was scrubbed, and then they eventually delayed that to Saturday, and they got down to zero on the clock. Their computers shut it down, another scrub. A couple of little problems they had with downrange. It was a boat, and then they stopped the countdown for that. Anyway, they plan on trying to launch this rocket again on next Saturday. Taran 1 is a 3D-built rocket. 100%, but 85%. Most anybody does is usually around 5% for 3D printing. This thing's all made out of aluminum, an aluminum alloy, actually. And they have this massive 3D printer that they're using to make these gigantic barrels, and then they eventually weld these barrels together, and that eventually forms the length of the roughly 110-foot rocket that they're trying to put to orbit. It's got two stages, and it has 9 engines.
That time complete.
They call them an Aeon engine. Aeon engine. There's 9 of them, similar to the design of SpaceX. You know, SpaceX has 9. Except, of course, this is much smaller. And I'm hoping they really make it to orbit, because if they make it to orbit, not only will it be the first mass-produced, or mostly produced, 3D, completely built rocket. You know, right there, that's history there. But they'll also make history because they'll be the first rocket company to make it to orbit using methane instead of the other fuels that everybody uses. They use kerosene for the Falcon 9. You have hydrogen that's used on the space shuttle and now on on the SLS system. That's hydrogen. A lot of companies are trying to use methane.